Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Sukkot, the clouds of glory. As we have now entered into the new year, please consider a donation to Pardes on behalf of the podcast. Pardes is a small institution, so your gift of any amount will make a real difference. You can donate online at any time via donate.pardesusa.org. Thank you very much. This week, we're pleased to welcome a new faculty member to the podcast. Dr. Mish Hammer-Kosai is a member of the faculty and will be discussing Sukkot, the Clouds of Glory. Dr. Hammer-Kosai teaches Talmud as a member of the Pardes faculty, and she also serves as the director of admissions for Pardes. And now, Dr. Mish Hammer-Kosai.
Thank you, Larry. It says in the Torah, in Leviticus 23, that we should celebrate the holiday of Sukkot. B'Sukkot teshvu shivat shamim kol ezrach b'Yisrael yeshvu b'Sukkot. Laman yedu dorotechem ki b'Sukkot hoshavti et b'nei Yisrael b'hotzi'i otam be'eretz Mitzrayim. Ani Adonai Eloheichem. You shall dwell in Sukkot for 7 days. Every citizen of Israel should sit in a sukkah, should dwell in a sukkah. In order that your generations should know that I caused B'nai Israel to dwell in Sukkot when I took them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And this verse, actually, which seems to be such a simple verse, actually raises tremendous questions for the rabbis. And it's brought down in a Tanaitic text, in a Midrash, in the book of Sifra. Leman yedu dorotechem ki b'Sukkot hoshavti et b'nei Yisrael b'hotzi'i otam mi'eretz Mitzrayim. In order that your generations should know that I caused you to cause B'nai Israel to dwell when I took them out of Egypt. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Sukkot mamash hayu. Rabbi Akiva Omer, V'sukkot anenei hakavod hayu. Rabbi Eliezer says that the Sukkot were literal Sukkot, as you probably thought. Rabbi Akiva, on the other hand, says that the Sukkot were not literally Sukkot, but rather were the clouds of glory. I'd like to begin by raising the question of who has the simple reading of the text. Many of you are probably assuming that Rabbi Eliezer, who said that the Jewish people, that the Israelites dwelled in Sukkot, literal Sukkot, have the simple reading. I'd like to suggest that perhaps it's a little bit more complex than that. Rashi. And my first hint to that is that Rashi, whose job, as we know, is to tell us the simple reading and some midrashim which fit well with the simple reading of the text, and so too all of the early Aramaic translations of the text, meaning a lot of the early interpreters of the text, seem to take Rabbi Akiva's position. Rashi says, when it says, Ki b'Sukkot hoshavti, because I caused you to dwell in Sukkot, Rashi says, Anenei hakavod. And I'd like to suggest a few possible reasons why perhaps things aren't quite as simple as it sounds. First of all, I caused you to dwell. This idea, it's a causative. I, God, caused you to dwell in a sukkah. I sat you in it. Not that you built for yourself, but rather that God provided the sukkah for you. And I wonder, if God were going to provide a sukkah, is going to provide you with a dwelling place, I would expect that God would provide me with a nice dwelling place, not with a shack which has some sort of makeshift roof, but with genuine shelter. If Hashem would invite me to a simcha, I would expect it to be a fancy simcha, not cucumber sandwiches. And to me, sukkah as a shack, Sukkot mamash, as Rabbi Eliezer suggests, is a not befitting, perhaps, of the stature of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, of God, who causes us to dwell. another issue that perhaps raises questions about this idea of whether the Sukkot, a really literal Sukkot, is that I want to know where in the Torah, in the book of Exodus, right? I know it says in the book of Leviticus, because I caused you to dwell in Sukkot. But when I took you out of Egypt, I know where to look for that in Exodus, in the early chapters of Exodus about how God took us out of Egypt. But when I look in those same chapters, I do not see that God actually caused us to live in Sukkot. There's no mention of shacks, of temporary dwellings. The Jews, it seems like, if you look in Exodus 16 or especially Exodus 33, in Numbers 11, it seems as though the Jewish people are living in tents rather than in Sukkot. Another thing that raises curiosity for me is just the implausibility. They're desert travelers. Desert travelers should reside in tents. Where would they find the foliage that would make sense that would be necessary for building a sukkah? I understand the idea of building a sukkah, which celebrates a harvest festival, that you will use pieces of the harvest. But when you're in the desert, where do you have the harvest? You don't have a harvest in order to draw on to build a sukkah from. And finally, a fourth reason is, why celebrate living in a shack or a booth? Is that really something to get excited about? Is that a gift that God gave us that's really worth commemorating? Why not commemorate that God gave us the food in the desert? Why specifically to focus on living in a shack or a booth, which is really nothing so fantastic? Once I've looked at the verse more carefully, I understand that while on first glance it makes perfect sense, Ki b'sukkot hoshavti, that when God says, I caused you to dwell in booths, that as Rabbi Eliezer says, he means booth. But on second glance, it's not so obvious that Rabbi Eliezer has the simple reading of the text. Perhaps Rabbi Akiva is really getting at something. In the book of Isaiah, perhaps even Isaiah also understood it that way, because in the fourth chapter of Isaiah, you know, as you all know, the biblical Hebrew tends to work, biblical poetry works in parallelism, and Yeshayahu, Isaiah, uses Anan and Sukkah in parallel with one another. He says, Anan yoman va'oshan, sukkah tiye letzel yomam. Okay, so both the anan will be, the cloud will be shade for you during the day, and so too the sukkah will be shade for you during the day. And Isaiah is using those two things in parallel, which seems to imply a certain parallel between those two words, that perhaps they have some sort of synonym impact. And the other thing is, of course, that while I can't find the Sukkot in the book of Exodus, I can find the Anane HaKavod. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is look for with you, what I want to do over the next 10 or 15 minutes is to unpack what is this experience of Sukkot. What does it mean to dwell in a booth? Both according to Rabbi Eliezer, who says that we dwell in literal booths, and according to Rabbi Akiva, who says that the Sukkot are not really about that we once dwelled in literal booths, but rather that we dwelled underneath the clouds of glory. And what we are really remembering is the clouds of glory. In order to understand how those two Sukkot religious experiences, the spiritual experience, if you will, would be different, I think it's worth looking a little bit at the clouds of glory and coming to understand what those clouds are. The association there with clouds. Clouds are a very, very rich symbol in the Bible, in the Tanakh. According to the Concordance, there are 87 appearances. So I'm just going to pick, our time is literal, is very limited, to pick a few examples. In Kabbalat Shabbat, one of the Tehillim there talks about the clouds as the dwelling place of God. Perhaps you're familiar with the With the chapter of Psalms, it says, Adonai Malach Tagel Haaretz Yismechu Im Rabim Anan Rafel Svivav Tzedeku Mishpat Mechon Kiso. God is King. Let the world rejoice. Let the many islands be happy. God is surrounded by clouds and mist. His throne is justice and righteousness. So here, the idea of the clouds are the dwelling place of God. There's a sense of perhaps divine mystery, transcendence, and also kingship, throne, that the clouds sort of serve as God's physical parallel to Tzedek U'Mishpat. To righteousness. The principle God dwells on is righteousness. The physical thing that God dwells on are clouds. Similarly, perhaps in Barchi Nafshi, the psalm that we read every day on each Rosh Chodesh, and also on Shabbat, at Shabbat Mincha time, there we praise God in nature. May my soul bless you, God. For the great way that you have been in nature. Hasam avim rechuvo, mahalech al kanfei ruach osem al achav ruchot. You make clouds your chariot. You ride on the winds, and your angels are the spirits, or your servants are the spirits. So God is utilizing all of nature to show God's mastery over the world. So twice in Psalms, you see God, you see the clouds as symbolizing God's transcendence, God's mercy, God's mystery, God's power, and God's kingship. I'd like to assume that the Ananei HaKavod, when we think about where are the clouds in the book of Exodus, as I said, we can't look and see the Sukkot, the booths, the literal booths in the book of Exodus, but we can see, the clouds. The cloud of glory appears for the first time in Exodus 13, where, incidentally, the Jewish people go to Sukkot as their first destination when they leave Mitzrayim, when they leave Egypt. V'yisu misukkot v'yachanu be'etam b'kzeh hamidbar. They left Sukkot and then they went to Etam as soon as they left Egypt. And God is going before them in the pillar of clouds, to show them the way. And in the nighttime, God is going in a pillar of fire to show them, so that they know where they're going, both day and night. The pillar of cloud never left the Jewish people all day, nor did the pillar of fire leave them during the night. It was always there before the nation. So the pillar of cloud was showing the Jewish people where to go. And in Exodus 14, we actually see that pillar of cloud not only serves as a visible symbol to Bnei Israel that God is in their midst and God is protecting them, but also to the enemy, to the Egyptians who are pursuing them, that God is in their midst. But the cloud actually provides genuine physical assistance. When the Egyptians are pursuing Bnei Israel as they're approaching the Red Sea, the pillar of cloud moves from in front of them, showing them the way, to behind them to become a physical shield. The Midrash talks about it as a shield, really protecting the Jewish people, getting in between the Jewish people, the Israelites, and the Egyptians, so that it not only serves as light, but as shade and as visible direction, but also as genuine physical protection, a sign of God in the midst of Bnei Israel, protecting them. On the other hand, at the time of in Exodus 19, when it's time for Har Sinai, for the God's revelation on Sinai, the revelation is symbolized by Anan Kaved Al Har, that the cloud is very, very heavy on the mountain, so that the cloud on the mountain is fear-inspiring, a sign that God has descended to Bnei Israel on the mountain and is present to reveal God's self to Bnei Israel. Similarly, in Exodus 40, when the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is being dedicated after the Jewish people in the last part of Exodus have built the tabernacle, a sign that they have succeeded in building a tabernacle, which is in God's pleasure, God takes pleasure in is V'yachas Ha'ananet Oel Moed, that the cloud fills the tabernacle, Kvod Adonai Maleit HaMishkan, and God's glory. Again, Ananei HaKavod, right? V'yachas Ha'anan, Ananei HaKavod, the glory of God fills the Mishkan. And Moshe isn't even able to enter into the tabernacle, into the Mishkan, the Ohel Moed, because the cloud is there, which is a sign, SheKavod Adonai Maleit HaMishkan, that the cloud is so full with God that it is dangerous to enter. So if we would adopt Rabbi Akiva's idea, but use just the Torah references of Ananei HaKavod, we would have a very rich understanding of what Sukkot is, an understanding of God as a transcendence, mysterious, powerful presence that comes down in his cloud, represented by his cloud visibly, to protect Bnei Israel in the desert from the Egyptians, to reveal God's self to us on Har Sinai and in the tabernacle. But God is a terrifying presence. Bnei Israel couldn't enter, not even Moshe could enter the Mishkan, because God was there. Now I understand this idea of the Sukkot being representative of Ananei HaKavod. The cloud is very present in the desert, a perfect protection from the sun, shelter, indeed the place where God caused us to dwell. But what a Sukkot! Nothing less than terrifying kingship of God watching over us. The religious experience of living in such a sukkah for the week is a powerful one, and perhaps a little bit of a terrifying one. Because Rabbi Akiva suggested that it was Ananei Kavod, I'm interested in also taking the next few minutes to look at the way the rabbis developed Ananei HaKavod, this pillar of cloud, which represents God's glory, and how they imagined that experience in the desert. I don't have time. There are many, many midrashim. I'm just going to allude probably to a couple and to pick one to read to you. I'm going to read to you from the Tosefta Masechet Sukkah, but there are parallels also in other texts. Tosefta Masechet Sota, chapter 4. There, Abraham, God promises that every good thing that comes to Bnei Israel, that the Jews are rewarded with, are really rewards for things that Abraham did for us. Everything good that Abraham did for God or for other people in the world was paid forward by God. God rewarded Abraham, not directly, but later rewarded Bnei Israel. So one of the things that Abraham did was welcome the angels, and he implored the angels, which he understood to be men. When he saw when he welcomed the guests, and he said, "Please take refuge and relax underneath the tree. V'yishanu tachat ha'etz. You should relax in the shade of the tree." V'af ha'makom natan levanav shiva ananei hakavod b'midbar. And so God wanted to repay Abraham for this wonderful chesed that he did for others, in providing shade, shelter. And God too gave his children 7 pillars, Ananei HaKavod, clouds of glory in the desert. Echad min yiminam, one on the right, ve'echad mismolan, ve'echad lifnehem, one on their right, one on their left, one in front of them, v'chad l'acharehem, and one after them, full service surround protection. Achad l'mala miroshehem, one over their head, v'achad l'shchina shebeneihem, and one that provided shade, if you will, from above, provided that, right, that's the simple reading, but another one that was actually God's presence dwelling among them. Va'amud anan shahaya makdim lefnehem horeg nachashim va'akravim v'soref sirim v'kotzim va'atad. That there was one that was actually sort of leading the way, a cloud whose job it was to kill anything dangerous, snakes and scorpions and burn brush and thorns and flatten the high places and raise the depths and make them a continuous ongoing highway. So that God actually created a strata, as it says in this midrash, that there is a highway that was clear, a beltway, a path that was easy for Bnei Israel to move through quickly and comfortably without getting stuck in all sorts of difficult paths, without anyone coming in from their right and their left, without a single traffic light or delay. God provided full protection. Perhaps some of you, there have been a number of articles in the newspaper about this new phenomenon, supposedly new phenomenon called helicopter parenting. That is, that nowadays parents are much more involved in children's life than, say, my parents were involved in my life. But I see that they are truly modeling God, adopting God's model, because God was so involved that he held both our right hand, our left hand, walked in front of us, walked in behind us, sheltered us from above and even from below. God was making sure that we were protected. So here you have an image of God as of incredible intimacy, not fear, right? If we had this idea that the cloud on Har Sinai terrified us and the cloud of the Mishkan made it dangerous for us to enter, but here the cloud is actually is quite the opposite, is there to make sure that not everything scary that we are insulated from, that there's nothing scary that can get at us. In Devarim Rabbah, Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi Yossi suggests that not only did the cloud protect us from every direction, but the cloud actually also washed our laundry. Now they want to know, well, it says that in Deuteronomy 29, it says that our clothes never wore out the whole time we were in Egypt. And they said that the whole time we were in the desert. And to that they ask, but didn't we grow? Well, we had some sort of magic, it turns out, chilazon. We had a special snail that helped the clothes grow with us. And then the Midrash asks, but didn't they need laundering? What about laundry? Certainly they need to wash their clothes. And the Midrash says, Ha'anan hayashaf behen umal benam, that the cloud would rub up against our clothes and whiten them. The whiteness of the cloud would rub off onto our clothes. So there is a sense, full service protection being offered by the clouds. And similarly, in the Mechilta, I don't know if this is similar, those I think are sort of mother-father images of intense protection for a slightly different image, but perhaps also one of intimacy. The Mechilta says, to what can this be compared? To a groom who brought a canopy to the doorway of the house of his bride in order that she will join him immediately. The cloud represents, the clouds of glory came and encamped on the rooftops of Ramses. Even before we left Egypt, the clouds of glory had shown up, similar to the groom who's coming to greet his bride. This tremendous anticipation here, not of the pair, of the excited mother or father, but of the excited potential spouse, courter, who is coming to greet his bride. And that's what the Ananei HaKavod symbolize. So on the one hand, I'm very moved by the image of the clouds of glory as they are in the Bible, of God's kingship and fear and protection, God's transcendence coming down and protecting us in a very intense and terrifying way in the desert. But I'm also moved in a very different way by the Midrashic portrayal of the clouds as a sign of God's intimate love for us, be it the love of a father or a mother or or a groom who's very excited, emotional intimacy, helicopter parents, parenting extremist protection. And I imagine sitting in the sukkah and feel and imagining this protection and remembering this protection that God shared for us in this tremendous way. Obviously, this is a very different experience than the experience that I would have had had I been sitting in Rabbi Eliezer's Sukkot Mamash, the literal Sukkot, which for me represent a vulnerability, a sense. So the Rashbam suggests that the Sukkah represents a sort of sense that that you don't have, that everything is temporary, that we are totally dependent, and that we don't have any control of our own lives, that we had to dwell in booths in vulnerability for 40 years without settled habitation or inheritance. And I think that that's a powerful image, but a very different image from that of Anagnei Kavod. I hope that, I need to end, but I hope that over the course of Sukkot that you will be able to share, both have moments of all of those experiences of God's kingship in the Sukkah, of God's intimate love in the Sukkah, and also of our tremendous vulnerability in this real world as symbolized by living in a fragile dwelling. Thank you very much, and have a Chag Sameach.
Thank you, Dr. Hamer Kotsoy. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.